This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Last couple of weeks, we've been powering through a couple of different topics: what she says versus what she means, what he says versus what he means, sports, rivalries, grudges, and some listener questions and comments. Now, evolutionary psychology, in my limited unprofessional experience, tends to evoke a lot of questions and a lot of different arguments from people when we talk about this. And sticking through this, the last few shows have actually, people have emailed me and some comments have been made through some of the posts I made on Reddit about this particular podcast. And so this episode is dedicated to the listeners, again, as we did a couple of weeks ago, to go over some questions and some comments and maybe some clarifying some situations from the evolutionary psychology perspective, with also a little bit of your twist on it for beating your genes. How's that sound, Dr. Lyle?
Excellent. Sounds good.
Excellent. So, let's see what we got here. The first thing goes into what I said just a few moments ago, which is about evolutionary psychology. And the question is, why is there such a disconnect between evolutionary psychology and the popular understanding of it?
Well, I would, you know, first of all, I don't know that there's any popular understanding of it, because I'm not sure what the person means. Maybe they mean, the little bits that they read in some forums on the internet. But evolutionary psychology really has almost no voice in modern culture. It's almost entirely ignored in academia. And so I'm not quite sure what they're referring to. But I would say this, people that get little smatterings of it, and you will see little smatterings of it with respect to man-woman dynamics being the most obvious issue, i.e., the simplest concept in evolutionary psychology is the differential investment that males and females of our species have in offspring. So males, i.e., males are philanderers and women are pair bonders. That will generate all kinds of discussion, and also will generate. Although some of that discussion will have some merit and have some kernels of truth in it, there's a lot of ignorance in not only that discussion, but in the responding discussions that follow. Evolutionary psychology upsets a lot of people, and that's because at its core issue, it tells us that we are here to compete sexually. And that the notion of competition is something that is upsetting for a lot of people, because it indicates that there are winners, losers, and everything in between. And that seems very unfriendly, and evolutionary psychology can seem very cold. And quite frankly, it is. And that's why life has so many of the edges that it does have, is because there are wins and losses, winners and losers. And this is the nature of existence. And so that plays out. The truth of those things are faced head on in evolutionary psychology, and that can make people quite uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, I always wonder when people say, like, winners and losers, like, when we're talking about life, does winning just mean surviving, or does it mean being happy, or does it mean securing a really high-value mate? Does it mean having a lot of friends? What do you think?
Yeah, I would say when I'm using that concept, I'm indicating that there are conflicts of interest between individuals, and where two individuals want the same thing. Two guys want to be CEO. Two guys want the corner office and be executive vice president. Two guys want to be banging the really hot secretary, but you know, one of the two of them might, you know, or maybe neither, because a third party will get there. So the bottom line is that there's going to be inevitable and sometimes substantial frustration and disappointment in life, dependent upon who you are and what your circumstances are. And the reason why most of that frustration exists is because of the competitive process that is going on. And so that doesn't mean to say that if you've lost that you're a loser. There are going to be 1,000 contests in your life, and you're going to win some and you're going to lose some. But some people win a hell of a lot more than other people, and they do so for largely reasons of their genetics.
Interesting, because this actually leads into another question from another listener who asks,
yeah,
why is it that we see such a huge discrepancy between society's empathy towards human needs until it comes to sexual satisfaction? And I'm assuming he means, so he says, we use tax money to fund basic needs of all kinds, but if you're a loser sexually, you're basically on your own in every way, shape, and form. Aren't outcast losers in the sexual realm more likely to become radical, rebellious, and dangerous to the group? And are there any Stone Age examples of us quelling these dangers, or any modern examples?
Well, he's making a point here that I think there's, I think we can get confused in sort of teasing this apart. Young men are in a position where they are competing with older men with more resources. And in our modern environment, we have a somewhat unnatural situation, whereas there is the capability of accumulating resources, where a resource accumulation was never possible in a Stone Age environment. You could accumulate status in the sense that you can have a track record of doing outstanding things, but you could not literally accumulate wealth. And so, therefore, the modern 24-year-old male is at an interesting disadvantage to the 34-year-old version of him, because the 34-year-old version may have spent the last 10 years accumulating wealth, if he's smart, or he's accumulated the ability to gain wealth that could not be had just by talent in the way that that would be true in the Stone Age. So in the Stone Age, we can already tell that in looking at hunter-gatherer societies, men's athletic prowess peaks in their late 20s. Interestingly enough, when they look at hunters, their maximum gains as hunters peak in their late 30s, which is very interesting. In other words, they're most talented young, but then they continue to learn and get more sophisticated at the craft. This looks a lot like professional athletics, where professional athletes, a lot of times by 26, 27, 28, are at the very height of their athletic dominance, but they may not be at the peak of their level of abilities. Their peak abilities seem to come a little bit later as they learn more tricks of the trade. Now, I forget. I've sort of wandered off topic. Tell me what this – oh, yes. So we've got this accumulation issue, and so therefore people in the modern environment, men in the modern environment, young men are at a competitive disadvantage as compared to where it is that they would have been in a Stone Age environment. And as a result, some of that is going to get frustrating. So they're at their height of their testosterone, and they're also feeling that they are being shut out sort of unfairly in some ways, or it may seem to them be unfairly. And so as a result, they are likely to engage in, if they don't have other ways to do so, let's suppose that they don't have the, they're not particularly gifted, and they're not particularly savvy, well, for one reason or another about the economic world. It could be the case that they wind up engaging in high risk, high reward behaviors in order to get those resources. So this is where drug dealing comes in and theft comes in, and potentially, interestingly enough, rape comes in. And so these are three high-risk, high-reward strategies for obtaining essentially female DNA. And so this person is correct in the sense that this is a problem. Now, However, that's a different problem than he was speaking of, slightly different problem, and that is that there is no particular way to distribute resources that makes any sense to me to people who are just flat out sexually unattractive, and essentially this, it's not like society has a lot of compassion for them in any way, shape, or form. It may or may not increase the desperation of behavior. Probably does not. Most people, most men do not have the aggressive, risky tendencies to make up for this. What they do is they simply bide their time. You will see this kind of behavior take place in the animal kingdom among animals that are not large enough and strong enough to challenge alpha for females. They will just patiently basically bide their time and hope for something to change. So, and that's what a lot of unattractive people will do. They'll just hope something one day falls into their lap. But yeah, I think it's an interesting issue about how little sensitivity there is in our society about that problem.
Yeah, it makes me think that it's survival of the fittest, even though we know it's survival of the genes.
Yes, I mean it's the survival of the fittest gene is the correct way to look at it, and
okay.
And so obviously, fit genes have tremendous opportunities relative to less fit genes, and very unfit genes have very limited opportunities, and they have, and therefore you can expect them to be in general more frustrated with their limited options. And maybe not at all interested in the options that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, this goes into the next question, actually, by another listener. He said that in today's world, especially in the first world, men seem to be overwhelmed because they are seeing the women that they want drenched in sexual attention, and it's petrifying them, often at an early age. Because guys in the middle to late teens, like you were just talking about, are just starting to figure out their place in the world. But the teen girls, the moment they hit legal age, can be launched all the way into the high status, and they aren't really keen to hide it. So what this listener is asking is, what's really left for men when women are getting all this attention long before the men are getting attention?
Well, what's left for men is the way it's always been. So in other words, even though the listener, I can hear their frustration, and that part of what you're hearing there is echoing what I'm talking about, that that older men can accumulate resources and that they can shower those resources or have those resources as inducements to, for example, an attractive 19-year-old female, a 35-year-old male. With a lot of resources can be more attractive, a whole lot more attractive than a similarly genetically attractive 19-year-old male with no resources. And so effectively, a very sexually attractive female, young female, has tremendous options and probably and has more being thrown at her than would have been the case in the Stone Age. And so, so what does it? So what happens? It's called figuring out how you're going to get a good job. In other words, if you're a male, your job is to start figuring out early how are you going to, quote, distinguish yourself from your competition. And the most difficult thing to do in the world is to make a lot of money honestly. And so as a result, this winds up being a fitness indicator. And the females are watching for this, and they are going to definitely be influenced by males that accumulate a lot of resources or males that accumulate status in some non-material realm. For example, maybe they can sing very well or play the guitar particularly well, et cetera. In other words, there's other ways to distinguish yourself. But remember, this is all against a backdrop that everybody is checking out everybody else physically. So the truth is that it has always been the case that if you are a mid-range male, you are never going to head for a high-range female, not without some spectacular chops. And that's, you know, whether you're 17 or 37. And so the so that the part of the frustration that the person is talking about is the fact is the mathematical inevitability that females in the top 10 percentile have tremendous power even as in their young lives. And as a male, unless you have a tremendous amount of genetic cachet, you're not going to be able to play there unless you do some extraordinary things to distinguish yourself in your mating career.
Mm-hmm. Now, so there's nothing we can do about our DNA.
Nope.
Except for maybe lifestyle disease reversal, but that's a whole different topic.
Right. Yes.
So
actually, the truth is that let me point something else out, and that is that it's probably never been a better time in the world to be a three. So let's suppose that you're a 30th percentile human, male or female. That seems like that's pretty brutal. But the truth is that it's not that brutal, and that's because so many of your competition are in horrendous condition. So since most people are in such poor physical condition, you, if you're a genetic three, you're somewhere in there in the bell curve. You are even a genetic two. In other words, you are plain. You certainly that individual, we can all see that they're not attractive. But the truth is that they can become a functional four or a five if they are not overweight and they're in good shape. And then if they apply their conscientiousness in ways to either accumulate resources if they're a male or otherwise distinguish themselves in some ways, then they can potentially play into the middle of the gene pool. And so they can find some satisfaction in doing well for them. Your system is basically doesn't need you to date Brooke Shields. That's not necessary for your nervous system. Your nervous system needs to believe that it got an excellent deal, and that's really what it is that it's after. And so, of course, it's increasingly exciting as we get higher up in the bell curve in terms of physical appeal. But the same system holds throughout all ranges of human attractiveness.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've talked about this with my friends, is there's some sentiment where at some point we kind of look and say, well, if the girl's not very intelligent, I'd rather have a girl who's not as hot, but she can keep a conversation going or be conscientious enough, et cetera, with personality differences.
Yeah, all of this is sort of, it's all in the, all of it is on the table because all of these have to do with a species that is potentially looking at long-term decisions in their mate selection. However, there's something more to these questions I can't remember, but I'm a little bit lost. You better figure out where we are and let's go from here.
Okay. Yeah, we're just talking about the questions that seem to I've been hearing it too in the tone of the questions is some of the frustration from younger men that they are dealing with.
Yeah, welcome to reality, okay? It's never been any different. It's never been any different. Okay? So, it has always been the case. I think there's a magazine I believe called Muscles and Money. And I believe I actually saw that on a shelf. It's probably been around for 20 years. I just didn't catch my eye until, you know, some random event took my eyes over there. But Muscles and Money says it all. In other words, the people who made that magazine are telling you exactly what it is that you know, that if you're a male, that you need to be in order to optimally compete, you need to be in excellent physical condition and make a lot of money. And those are the two things that you can potentially control. You cannot control so many other things about you that the female is designed by nature to assess. But those two things you do have some control over, and so that's why they've got a magazine about it.
So this leads us to another question. Again, this forum and the listeners who've been listening, mostly male from what I gather, and so the questions are from that part, you know, from that vein. Okay, question.
Sure.
A lot of men turn to self-improvement because of a breakup. The motivation to reattract lost love is strong. But what would be Dr. Lyle's thoughts on heartbreak and obsession with one woman that dumped you from an evolutionary standpoint, and what can be done about it?
More than one possible answer to that. So let me give you sort of two or three different answers, because I'm not sure where that individual is coming from or whether or not they just sort of came up with that idea more generally. The one reason is that suppose that a male was in a relationship with a female and he felt like he was, you know, over-rewarded. And he felt like he was over-rewarded and got accepted. So he felt like he made it. And he was absolutely elated with the situation. So he was feeling parabond all the way. Now that male now, let's suppose that we fast forward 6 months or a year or 2 years, gets dumped by said female. So said female, for whatever reasons, is not happy with the situation. Now, this being the case, the male is certainly, it's certainly reasonable for him to feel like that he may not be that far away from qualifying for that female. And that female was a screaming deal as far as he was concerned. And so therefore, it's a pretty good idea to keep hammering away for a while and just see if you can change your mind. Interestingly enough, it turns out that of people that remarry after a divorce, 1 in 10 of them remarries their ex-spouse that they divorced, for God's sakes. Okay? So it tells you the importance of, if you ever qualified or seem to have qualified and you are damn happy about it because you felt over-rewarded, then of course it would make sense, evolutionarily speaking, to be, quote, obsessed with that female and not give it up. Okay. Now, the second of all, often if you damn near qualified because she slept with you for 9 months or 19 months, and then she booted you, then you might suddenly realize, you intuitively understand that she's running a cost-benefit analysis on you. And so you look at yourself and you say, well, gee, what could I do to improve my cost-benefit analysis? Maybe I can go back to school and get a degree so I can get a better job and make more money and drive a better car and have a better house. Maybe I can get to the gym and strip off 10 pounds of fat and add 10 pounds of muscle, okay? Maybe I can then, you know, dress in a little cooler clothes. Maybe I can quit smoking and drink, whatever. In other words, now we're going to start, this is our self-improvement campaign. And the self-improvement campaign is clearly directed at two targets. Number one, it's directed at the female who we may be able to win back by demonstrating to her that we've altered the cost-benefit equation. And it's also, what the heck, as long as we are trying to win back that specific female, we might as well get ourselves, you know, if we're going to have to hustle, we're not going to just charm her with a little bit of energy. As long as we're hustling, it isn't after just one female we're after, but we're out to improve our entire competitive position with other females as well. So these are some things that are going on. A third thing that's going on potentially is that sometimes males have a narcissistic streak and they are controlling nut cases, and it is they're highly disagreeable individuals that are deeply offended when they are dumped. And so it turns out that these individuals, they may have also an obsessive sort of a nature, possibly, for example, disagreeable and a bad combination would be emotionally unstable, disagreeable, and a little bit on the low conscientiousness side. Now, these, or worse, if we go further on the low conscientiousness side, we're going to wind up with a psychopath. But all we're really needing here is your average narcissistic nutcase that can't tolerate the fact that he got dumped, okay? Now, these people are dangerous, and they can obsess about a female potentially for years. It is not super uncommon for them to certainly batter those females. on repeated occasions, and then sometimes murder them. And so the evolutionary underpinnings of this are probably look like the following, and that is that if a female defects on you, then a one evolutionary strategy is to beat her up or intimidate her into staying, because you then alter the cost-benefit equation of her leaving. And then if she leaves, you might even, in the Stone Age, you might even murder this woman in order to send a signal to other women that they had better not leave you. Okay? Now, so this is, I know this sounds like horrifying. If you're a modern, normal woman, or particularly if you're a feminist scholar listening, you're like, what is this nutcase talking about? Okay? Unless you understood that we were talking through the lens of evolutionary history to try to understand this kind of behavior in the male, this discussion wouldn't make any sense. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to look down through the genetic history of the organism to try to understand why it is that we sometimes see the behavior that we see. So sometimes the edgy, angry, obsessive, you know, screaming, stalking behavior that we see is about defending the honor of the narcissist who is dumped. One would have to see this very clearly in the case of O.J. Simpson. The only possible way to understand O.J. would obviously this guy who had a phenomenal amount of freedom and cachet to lose, but his Stone Age brain would not allow him to let this highly attractive ex-wife essentially parade around Beverly Hills demonstrating that she was fine without him. That was intolerable, and he murdered her. And it was no average murder. This is a murderous rage, which is characteristic of the narcissist. So the anyway, that's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on with respect to men not wanting to let go.
And this is, of course, we're talking about the lower of the bell curve. So, what is it, one or two standard deviations away? So, this is not very common by any stretch.
Oh, no. This is exceedingly rare. But I have to tell you, it is not uncommon at all for me to see in highly attractive women that highly attractive women, somewhere along the lines, they have dealt with some narcissistic stalking nutcase. This is actually very common for highly attractive women, and I don't know that anybody's ever pulled data on this, but I believe that if anybody did, I mean, this is one heck of a doctoral dissertation, that it is not your 7 or 8 female who has this problem. It's the 9s and up, because the 9s and up are so genetically valuable, and the narcissist very often is pushy enough that he can get to those females at least superficially and maybe even get into bed with them for a while with their superficial charm. And then when they get rejected after the female smokes it out, then they're enraged and all these activities start. So it's not so – it is not – I wouldn't call it rare. Certainly murder is rare, but stalking and threatening and aggressive behavior physically is not rare at all. And an awful lot of high-end, highly attractive females have had to live with that at some point in their life.
Okay. All right, Next question. This is about discussing the sexual marketplace value calibration in more detail. So this is a listener who actually had a session with you, Dr. Lyle, and the following point came up. He writes, I had a session with Dr. Lyle, and it came up that I got rejected by a super hot girl who was 18 years old. Initially, I qualified as her partner and even slept with her, but Dr. Lyle suggested that due to her lack of life experience, she's not properly calibrated to the sexual marketplace and does not know her true value. So after conquering me and getting my commitment, she stopped sending me esteem signals and covertly communicated rejection, that I no longer qualify as her partner, and she moves on to see if she can get a better deal. This sounds like something I heard called hypergamy. At the same time, Dr. Lyle suggested that true love pair bond is most likely if both partners are sufficiently calibrated to their own value and they perceive the partner as the best option they've seen in the last 3 years. But here's where things get tricky. If the calibration process is dynamic, will it eventually fail to maintain equilibrium, resulting in one person always pursuing somebody better? And can you comment on the extents or the limits of this calibration and how it affects relationships? It's a lot there.
Yeah, no, that's all very good. It all makes complete sense if you think about it. That the nervous system would be very carefully engineered to make sure that it is expending its energies in an intelligent fashion, as intelligent as it can figure out how to do it. And so particularly think about, for example, a male think for example about a female nervous system going to be very careful with these eggs and trying to make sure that she gets excellent value in exchange for those eggs. If a male is going to pair bond into a situation, he better only be pair bonding if he feels like he's getting excellent value, because he's giving up casual mating strategy. So let's suppose a male is an 8 and the female he's got his eyes on at the moment is a 7. We would expect him to not be interested in pair bonding with her, because he could have her equivalent in casual mating strategy. And so we would not expect him to develop the kind of connection and oxytocin bonding. That shouldn't work. It shouldn't work that way. Now, it could work that way if he wasn't calibrated. Let's suppose that for some strange reason, he was kind of a chubby kid until he was about 19, and then somebody told him how to eat a little bit differently, and he started to exercise, and he's a late bloomer. And so now, you know, he has been a 5. Now he's an 8, doesn't know it, so he's a little in the gray area for calibration, meets a 7, and he feels like he's willing to pair bond. Meanwhile, she's all excited about it and try to march the guy to the altar. So now, so you can see that don't think about these as people. Think about them as machines. And if we think about machines trading with each other, then they should be very careful to be calibrated intelligently in a way so that they do not give away resources. That would be a mistake. So if we see any characteristic of modern humans, we see that they do not give away their resources easily at all. Men tend to be real cheap with their resources, and females tend to be very stingy sexually with males that are their genetic inferiors. So they're, when I say inferiors, I mean in terms of sex appeal, not anything else. So the so as a result, it's going to be the case that very often people are not very well calibrated in their youth. So an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-old, an 18, 19, 20-year-old female, a highly attractive female, for example, in this particular case, does not really know what her reach is, doesn't know. So let's suppose that that she's, you know, real average personality in terms of nothing special at all. Now, does she think that her reach goes to a 25-year-old guy with, you know, maybe she's got a net worth of $2,000. Maybe a 25-year-old guy with a net worth of $30,000 seems pretty impressive. But then the next month, she bumps into just as attractive a guy who's 27 years old with a $100,000 net worth, okay? So who's very, very interested. So in other words, she's trying to calibrate, and so therefore at an early age, she has not seen enough rejection cues to find out what her upper limits are. And that's how this is going to work. So the calibration process is going to be fed by not only your wins, but more importantly by your losses, and finding out where your ceiling is with respect to the opposite sex. When two people have both found their ceilings, so they know that they are, let's suppose, they're somewhere, you know, 80th percentile plus or minus 5 percentile. So they more or less know where they are. Those people that more or less know where they are now in a position where when they get a deal that is moderately better than they would normally expect, they're likely to be very excited about this, okay? And now if somehow somebody seems to be giving them a deal that's a lot better than they expect, now a mature, intelligent person smells a rat, And they know that, no, there's got to be something wrong with it, and probably something badly wrong with it. This is the Hollywood's version of what I call the broken 10. So if you're Renee Zellweger and Jerry Maguire, you better smell a rat, because you don't deserve that guy. Okay, so this is, and of course, the whole drama plays out that, you know, he's a mess, and he's not into her at all. But the bottom line is this, that calibration systems are going to – now, the other question that the person asks is, calibration systems would inherently be dynamic in the sense that your feedback from the world is always variable to some degree. So things are changing and your stock is falling and rising a little bit. And it turns out that whenever there are shocks to people's stock, we find out that it does disturb the calibration system of people. So, for example, when men get promotions, they are very likely to dump their wives, substantial promotions. In other words, if they do much better financially than they had expected to, or that it looked like their previous prospects, that's why we call the second one or the third one a trophy wife, for God's sakes. So now they can afford the trophy that they could not previously afford. And so this is true. That these things are potentially dynamic. They aren't necessarily dynamic, but they are potentially dynamic. And it's also true that people can change in terms of their own sexual worth for other reasons. They may become less attractive or more attractive for various and sundry reasons, and they then may feel the need to go test their calibration out of the marketplace. So there's a subtext to this question, which I think is very interesting. And that is, the subtext is, once again, we're hearing a little bit of the frustration that comes from people saying, you know, isn't there a way, how is it that this Rubik's Cube is all supposed to work out just right? And gee, it just seems to me that there's threats from all angles to this thing working out just right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, if we're going to look for the little nirvana where people do a little bit of dating, you know, from 15 to 23 and have two or three breakups or six or seven little breakups, and then they meet somebody really good when they're 26, and then the other person feels great about them and they feel great about the other person, and then they like get together and then everything is good for the next 50 years, good luck to you. Okay? If that happens to you, you are a 1 in 100 shot. That is what is supposed to happen to you. That is the fairy tale about what is supposed to happen to you. But the realities of what happened are much, much messier and much more competitive and edgy and heartbreaking than that.
And it seems to reward constant improvement if it's possible. So if people understand that they are constantly under threat of defection, or they're constantly being evaluated in a cost-benefit analysis, then does this increase their motivation to improve constantly?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that certainly it's useful to understand that you are mating in captivity, which is the name of a book that I never read, but I just read little excerpts, and it made a lot of sense to me. I think this was a woman biologist or somebody like this that wrote this thing. You're mating in captivity in the modern environment. We have completely altered the landscape and reduced the direct competition when people are when they're paired up in financially tied up messes, marriages, relationships where we're living in the same space, et cetera, et cetera. These aren't necessarily messes. I'm just explaining. This creates a lot of problems that people don't see coming.
Yeah, I've called them barriers to exit, basically.
Yes, barriers to exit. And so when you put barriers to exit in a relationship, you reduce tremendously the threat of competition. And when you reduce the threat of competition, you reduce the energy needed to compete. And so as a result of that, everybody, this is what I call the chiseling chip, that people start chiseling each other in their relationship, and then pretty soon they chisel away at the trade itself, and you can see what would then take place. that essentially the female is thinking, well, I don't have to like get in such great a shape. I don't look bad relative to how I looked before. And, you know, where is he going to go? And he's thinking, well, why should I hustle and look that great? And why should I hustle for extra resources? What's the bother? We're all stuck in this thing anyway. And so as a result, they start effectively chiseling each other in a reciprocal fashion. And I'm not saying that this is either conscious or that it is inevitable. I'm just telling you that it is very common, at which point they finally are in a situation where they're not really trading very much at all. And the sexuality can essentially unwind itself down to near nothing or nothing. And a lot of relationships are like this, much more than anybody wants to admit. And this is there's numerous possible reasons for this. But I will argue that one of the reasons is because there is a lack of a threat of competition in that relationship. And that is probably the biggest thing, that if you are lucky enough to be in a good relationship, you should be highly cognizant of that possibility.
Try and tell the girl you're dating that you're not going to marry her for that reason. We'll see how that works. Next question. Yeah, we're not going to get into that part, but
we'll still clear of that until we hear a shrill voice on the phone.
Thankfully, my mother's not listening today. But, okay,
yes. All right.
So the next question is, the question has to do with sexual chemistry and casual mating strategy versus pair bond strategy and sexual dynamics in the bedroom. So the question is, can you discuss what makes things, quote, hot and heavy in terms of sexual chemistry in the bedroom for casual mating? And chemistry meaning how much a woman is enjoying sex, if she's achieving orgasms, etc. And does the difference in sexual market value between men and women create that spark on the part of the female? In other words, as a man, does trading down lead to better casual sex for the woman?
Yes. Great question. Love it. Very, very insightful. Of course it does. So I can't tell you how many times I have bit my lip as a psychotherapist or just listening to some woman talk to me for some reason where they are describing the situation that sounds like as follows. And please, of course it can go the other direction, but since it's most memorable to me when it comes from this direction, this is how I will describe it. Dr. Lyle, it was just like magical. It's just so amazing. It was just amazing chemistry. You know, it's just like just absolutely the best, you know, of my life. It's just the best experience I had. And, you know, that I don't know what's wrong. It has to be, both people have to be experiencing that. You know, it's just part of the magic and how that I could see it. I could tell how much he was into it too. But he hasn't called me back. Yeah, that's right. It's the best you ever had because you were sleeping up. So, of course, you were incredibly excited in that situation because your genes are calibrating the situation and detecting that they are getting a screaming deal. Meanwhile, the person on the other end of this, generally it's the male on the other end of it, and the reason why that would be true is because if there's going to be extraordinary excitement in a situation, remember that females are the controlling factor in human sexual activity. So as a result, if the female is receptive and highly excited, there's exactly one way that that's going to get there, other than obviously a great love situation that is the beginnings of a pair bond. Most likely, if a female is all hot and bothered and all excited, the reason why that's true is that she's being over-rewarded genetically in terms of sex appeal. And so the answer to the question is yes, that if you are a male that seeks casual mating strategy with females that are extremely excited to be with you and that are going to be twisting themselves into a yogic pretzel on your behalf, that if this is what you seek, then by all means, head to the bars and hit on the female that is 20 to 30 percentile points lower than you are estimation-wise, and go have yourself a grand time.
Very interesting. So will the more disagreeable males desire this, because since they're disagreeable, they'll need more feedback than would be fair, that they're quote performing well?
Oh, I wouldn't have thought about that. I would assume that more disagreeable males in general, I think, are going to seek casual mating, in the sense that they don't mind the female getting burned, essentially. So, but no, I understand what you're saying there, and that's an intriguing idea, and I can't necessarily line that all up. We'll have to think about that some more.
Okay. Okay, final story. This is a very well thought out question, a couple of different questions in here. But it has to do with the podcast we did a few months ago about the man paying for the first date and how much we pay for dinner, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So Dr. Lyle said previously that the best strategy to play to attract women is pair bonding strategy. This listener disagrees with this, particularly just on a first and second date. And in his opinion, you should exclusively play casual mating strategy. And here's his reasons why. First, Dr. Lyle said you should always pay for dinner and pay for something in your price range. This listener would say no to dinner on the first or second date unless she's earned it. And the reason why is that in the modern dating market, the value of dinner to a woman is practically nothing. If you take a girl out for dinner, it makes you one in a million who's willing to do so and will likely not impress her. On top of that, there are many women in the modern world who aren't looking for commitment and are only coming for the free resources you will offer. This can be a quick drain if you go on a lot of dates. And his recommendation is just to take her out for a beer for the first date and never go over around $10, $20. Secondly, assuming you make money and are able to take her out on a big expensive dinner, you are setting her initial expectations high. This will filter for women who like you because of the resources you present and not necessarily due to your personality. On the other hand, the beer or two will not prevent a girl who's genuinely clicking with your personality from requesting a second date. This listener states that he makes a pretty good income, and it's scary how women will sniff it out and say all the right things to just try to get a piece of that. He says you have to protect yourself, and lowballing those first few dates is a little extra protection from the gold diggers. Finally, his theoretical point is if you play pair bond strategy, are you on some level signifying that she has more value than you, and therefore you're offering resources to make up for the attraction difference? However, if you initially play casual mating strategy, you'll position yourself as someone who's fancier than your date. Will this raise her level of interest in you, as she may wonder what makes you so confident and if her low evaluation of you is calibrated correctly? Dr. Lyle says that the ultimate goal of a woman would be to pair bond with someone she finds fancier than herself. That person would typically play casual mating strategy with her. By initially approaching with a casual mating strategy and eventually settling into a pair bond situation, are you maximizing your chances with prospective high quality women?
Oh, okay. There's so much in here. I'm undoubtedly going to miss a whole bunch of it as I just start to wind out. I'm thinking about the very last thing first. I've already forgotten the other comments. First of all, you're not going to bluff people. So one of the big things in the sort of really cheesy third-rate thinking and things like the pickup artist is that these people don't understand that the women have full ability to calibrate you. So keep in mind you're not bluffing anybody. So the notion that we are going to signal to women that we're not that impressed with them and therefore we're just going to, have a beer with them is this is not going to impress any female. Let me explain the situation here. We have to begin with the end in mind. My recommendations are coming from a particular perspective that is not always the perspective that would be somebody's, the one that someone would be using, because their goals might be different. My perspective would be that I'm going on this date because I'm interested in the person as a potential pair bond. If I am interested in the person as a potential pair bond, we know what that means. We know that the female is more sexually attractive than I am. That's why I'm interested in her as a pair bond. If the female is not more sexually attractive than I am, then I am not interested in her as a pair bond. But in that case, I'm not going out on the date. Okay, so once again, we have to get clear, you know, from which vantage point my advice is coming from. So let's suppose that this takes place. If I've already met the woman, and I'm very interested, and I ask her out, you're darn right I'm going to ask her out to dinner for the following reason. And incidentally, if I haven't met her, but I believe that she's more sexually attractive than I am, then let's suppose it's Match.com or their Tinder or whatever it is, then I'm absolutely going to ask her out to dinner for the following reason. The notion that the woman could meet you for a beer and, quote, click with your personality if she is more sexually attractive than you are is absurd. The truth of the matter is that women's sexuality is inherently defended. And so women don't know this. So they will tell you, oh, no, you know, there's times when they really click with somebody. Right. They click with somebody who's 10 or 20% more sexually attractive than they are. That's who they click with. Okay. So, of course, and so this is a lack of intuition on the male who's not understanding this. The male, now, can it happen? Of course it can, particularly if you're starting to talk about people where everybody's in the top 10 percentile. But I'm not talking about that, because those people don't need any advice or help anyway. So let's suppose we've got a guy who's a 6, and let's suppose that what he would really be aiming for legitimately would be a 7.5. When the 7.5 meets a 6 for beer, and that's the meeting, first of all, good luck to you getting that meeting, but let's suppose you do. The reason why the female would want to meet you for a beer is because she thinks that you're so far below threshold, but she's not so sure, that she thinks that you're going to be weird and she doesn't want to commit to an hour with you. That's what the deal is. She's not after a bunch of resources. She's actually trying to save herself a bunch of hassle and time and energy with some loser that she doesn't want to spend the time with. Now, so let's suppose you're not a loser and you would be interested in her. Let's suppose you haven't met her, but you're a 6. You think she's a 7.5. You think that she's going to qualify at that differential for being pair bond material. You hope to qualify. One thing I can guarantee you, it is exceedingly unlikely that you're going to qualify in the first 10 or 15 minutes, okay? All of the research indicates that the more exposures that you have to a female, the more attractive you'll become, all things being equal. All things being equal, i.e., you're not a jerk, you don't have horrendous manners, you don't eat with your elbow in your soup, and you don't have bad breath, okay? So let's look at the situation. Let's look at the situation where she would actually like your personality. The truth is that we know that she will find you more attractive after an hour and a half than she finds you after 15 minutes. Okay, now, after 15 minutes, let's suppose that that was Miss Wright for you. And let's suppose that had you had 15 or 20 exposures to her in a class that you would take over a semester, some art class, that you got to know her and her little locker was next to yours and you got to chit-chat with her and she got to know you, et cetera. Well, let me tell you something. Your odds are going up perceptibly with every hours and a half's worth of interaction in that art class all through that course of that semester. All of the research evidence overwhelmingly supports this. Okay, now, so as a result, your job at date one when you are playing Parabond strategy is you are already behind, my friend, already thinks that she's looking for, quote, instant chemistry because she's had it before. She's had it every time some guy's 10 or 20% more attractive than she is. And those guys are interested in seeing her again. Why? Because they're interested in short-term casual mating strategy. And she's been dumped and heartbroken 9 times in the last, you know, 6 years behind this strategy. So your strategy is different. You're a tortoise. And as a result, what you're trying to do is just get date number two. That's your only job. Your job on date one is not to cheap it out. if it happens that you show up and it turns out that she qualifies for you physically, you're there to sell your inner beauty as much as you can and as smoothly as you can for the hour and a half that she has granted you to be in front of you. The truth of the matter is, it is only right and appropriate that you pay. The truth is that her sexuality is vastly more valuable than your sexuality. And so as a result, you are paying for her time in order to get to pitch to her. And this is what is known as being a gentleman, okay? So this is honest courtship. We're not trying to trick her. We're not trying to bluff her. We're not trying to cheap it out, nothing of the kind. Now, what's going to happen? Well, if it's on Match.com or so forth, trust me, her pictures are 10% better than the truth. So are yours, I hope. They better be. You know what I mean? Or you're going to get killed by the competition. So the bottom line is that you may wind up catfished, and now you're stuck with a dinner situation, you know, that with somebody that doesn't qualify for you. Well, you make the best of it. That's part of the game of life. Your job is here to be ready and to be ready to strike. Chance favors the prepared mind, okay? You will not get that many chances in this life. If you're an average guy, you're not going to get that many chances in life with a girl who is, you know, 10 to 20% superior to you, who would actually find you appealing enough and that the personalities would click well, okay? She wouldn't, you know, she's no way knows this after 15 minutes and is going to walk away, and she will report to her therapist, I just didn't feel anything, okay? That's what she'll tell her friends. Nah, didn't have it, didn't have chemistry. Done. You're out of the game, okay? This is why this entire letter, what this guy is writing, is based on some very important misconceptions about the real leverages here that are in this game and how to play the game optimally if what you are seeking is a pair bond strategy. David Buss has made it very clear that the research shows that a huge percentage of female courtship is honest, okay? A lot of people are actually trying to play it straight. They're trying to find exactly this dynamic situation. One of the biggest problems is the female does not know that there is a tremendous cap on her sexuality that can come off over when she's been repeatedly exposed to a male that is actually of sufficient quality and personality and sufficiently at threshold with respect to her physical interests. She will not know that until she has had repeated interactions with this guy and has gotten to know him. And so you will lose if you try to cheap this out and not grab every minute of her attention that you can.
Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure out, you have the Doug download. I'm trying to figure out an alliteration for what I should call.
I don't know.
Nothing really rhymes with me. You know, every time we did these games.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.